Chapter 7. A Refuge. It seemed to be an outlying suburban street where the taxi stopped, for everything was quiet and children were sitting, playing on the edge of the pavement. A man with a pile of old clothes slung over his shoulder kept a watchful eye on the house windows above him as he cried his wares. Carl was so very weary that he felt out of place when he stepped out of the car on the asphalt, which lay warm and bright in the morning sunshine.
"Is this really where you live?"
he called into the taxi. Robinson, who had slept peacefully during the whole journey, growled an indistinct affirmative and seemed to be waiting for Carl to carry him out.
"Then you don't need me any more. Goodbye,"
said Carl, and started to walk away down the slight slope of the street.
"But Carl, what on earth are you thinking of?"
cried Robinson, and his anxiety was so great that he stood up in the car fairly straight, except that his knees were somewhat shaky.
"I've got to go now," said Carl, who had observed Robinson's speedy recovery.
"In your shirt sleeves?"
asked Robinson.
"I'll soon earn myself another jacket," replied Carl,
and he nodded confidently to Robinson, raised his hand in farewell, and would have departed in earnest had not the taxi driver called out,
"Just a moment, sir."
Unfortunately, it appeared that the man laid claim to a supplementary payment to cover the extra time he had waited in front of the hotel.
"Of course,"
cried Robinson from the car, supporting the justice of his demand.
"You kept me waiting such a long time there. You must give him something more."
"Yeah, that's so," said the taxi driver.
"Yes, if I only had anything to give,"
said Carl, searching in his trouser pockets, although he knew it was useless.
"I have only you to look to,"
said the taxi driver, planting himself squarely before Carl.
"I can't ask anything from a sick man."
From the door, young lad, with a nose half eaten away, drew nearer and stood listening a few paces away. A policeman, who was just making his round of the street, lowered his head, took a good look at the figure in shirt sleeves, and came to a stop. Robinson, who had noticed the policeman, made the blunder of shouting to him from the other window of the car,
"It's nothing! It's nothing!"
as if a policeman could be chased away like a fly. The children, who had been watching the policeman, saw him stop, had their attention drawn to Carl and the taxi man, and came trotting up. In a doorway across the street, an old woman stood stolidly at gaze.
"Rossman!"
shouted a voice from above them. It was Del Marsh, standing on the balcony on the top floor. It was difficult to see him against the pale blue sky, but he was obviously wearing a dressing gown and observing the street through a pair of opera glasses. Beside him, there was a big red sunshade, under which a woman seemed to be sitting.
"Hello?"
he shouted at the very top of his voice to make himself understood.
"Is Robinson that too?"
"Yes," replied Carl, powerfully supported by a second, far louder, "Yes," from Robinson in the car.
"Hello,"
Delmar shouted back.
"I am coming at once."
Robinson leaned out of the car.
"That's a man," he said,
and this praise of Del Marsh was directed at Carl, at the driver, at the policeman, and anyone else who cared to hear it. Up on the balcony, which they still kept watching absently, although Del Marsh had already left it, from under the sunshade there rose a large figure which proved to be indeed a woman in loose red gown. She lifted the opera glasses from the ledge of the balcony and gazed through them down at the people below, who began to turn their eyes away from her, though lingeringly. Carl looked at the house door where Del Marsh was to appear, and then right through it into the courtyard, which was being traversed by an almost unbroken line of workmen, each of whom bore on his shoulder a small but obviously very heavy box. The taxi driver had stepped across to his car, and to employ the time was polishing the lamps with a rag. Robinson felt all his limbs, seeming astonished because in spite of the most intent examination he could discover none but trivial aches, and then bent down and cautiously began to undo one of the thick bandages round his leg. The policeman held his black baton at a slant before him, and quietly waited with that deep patience which policemen must have, whether they are on ordinary duty or on the watch. The lad with the eaten nose sat down on a doorstep and stretched his legs before him. The children gradually crept nearer to Carl, for although he paid no attention to them, he seemed the most important of all of them because of his blue shirt sleeves. By the length of the time that elapsed before Del Marsh's arrival, one could measure the great height of the house, and Del Marsh came in great haste, having stopped merely to tie the cord round his dressing gown.
"So here you are,"
he cried, with both delight and severity in his tone. At each great stride he took, his bright-colored pajamas could be seen for an instant. Carl could not quite make out how Delmarsh could go about in such negligent attire here in the town, in this huge tenement, on the open street, as if this were his private villa. There was a big change in Delmarsh, as well as in Robinson. His dark, clean-shaven, scrupulously clean face with its rough modeling of muscle looked proud and inspired respect. The hard glitter of his eyes, which he still kept half shut, was startling. His violet-colored dressing gown was certainly old, spotted, and too big for him. But from that squalid garment there emerged at the neck the folded swaths of an enormous scarf of dark, heavy silk.
"Well?"
he asked, addressing everyone. The police stepped a little nearer and leaned against the body of the car. Carl gave a brief explanation.
"Robinson's a bit wobbly, but he can easily climb the stairs if he tries. The driver here wants something extra besides the fares that I have already paid him, and now I'm going. Good day."
"You are not going," said Delmarsh.
"I've told him that too," Robinson announced from the taxi.
"I'm going all the same," said Carl, taking a few steps.
But Delmarsh was already beside him, forcibly holding him back.
"I say you are staying here," he cried.
"Let me go," said Carl,
and he made ready to gain his freedom with his fists if necessary, little hope as he had of downing a man like Delmarsh. Yet the policeman was standing by, and the taxi driver, and the street was not so quiet but that occasional groups of workmen passed through it. Would they tolerate it if Delmarsh were to mishandle him? He would not like to be left alone with him in a room, but why not here? Delmarsh was now quietly paying off the taxi driver, who pocketed the unmerited and substantial addition to his fare, with many bows and out of gratitude, went up to Robinson and began to consult with him how he was to be best get out of the car. Carl saw that he was unobserved. Perhaps Delmarsh would mind it less if he just slipped away. It was best to avoid a quarrel if it could be avoided, and so he simply stepped onto the road as the quickest way of getting clear. The children rushed over to Delmarsh to let him know that Carl was escaping, but Delmarsh had no need to intervene, for the policeman stretched out his baton and said,
"Stop! What's your name?"
he asked, tucking his baton under his arm and slowly bringing out a notebook. Carl now looked at him carefully for the first time. He was a powerfully built man, but his hair was almost white.
"Carl Rossman," he said.
"Rossman,"
the police echoed him, no doubt simply because he was a quiet and conscientious man. But Carl, who was now having his first encounter with the American police, saw in this repetition of his words a certain mistrust. And indeed, his position was probably precarious, for even Robinson, though he was so occupied with his own troubles, was making dumb, imploring gestures from the car to Delmarsh, begging him to help Carl. But Delmarsh refused him with a hasty shake of the head, and looked on without doing anything, his hands in the huge pockets of the dressing gown. To a woman who had just come out of the house, the lad on the doorstep explained the whole situation from the very beginning. The children stood in a half-circle behind Carl and silently looked up at the policeman.
"Show your identification papers," said the policeman.
That could only be a formal question, for without a jacket one was not likely to have many identification papers in one's pockets. So Carl remained silent, deciding to answer the next question fully, and so, if possible, to gloss over his lack of identification papers. But the next question was,
"So you have no papers?"
And Carl had to answer,
"Not with me."
"But that's bad," said the policeman,
looking thoughtfully around him and tapping with two fingers on the cover of his notebook.
"Have you got an occupation?"
he asked at last.
"I was a lift boy," said Carl.
"You were a lift boy, so why aren't you one any longer? And in that case, what are you living on now?"
"I'm going to look out for another job."
"I see. Have you just been dismissed?"
"Yes, an hour ago."
"Suddenly?"
"Yes,"
said Carl, raising his hand as an apology. He could not tell the whole story here, and even if that had been possible, it seemed quite hopeless to think of averting a threatened injury by the recital of injuries already suffered. And if he had not been able to get his rights when faced by the kindness of the man addressed and the insight of the head waiter, he certainly could not expect to get them from the company gathered here in the street.
"And you were dismissed without your jacket?" asked the policeman.
"Why, yes," said Carl.
So in America, too, it was the habit of authorities to ask questions about what they could see for themselves. how exasperated his father had been over the pointless inquiries of the officials when he was getting Carl's passport. Carl felt like running and hiding himself somewhere, if only to escape answering any more questions. And now the policeman put the very question which he feared most of all, and which he had been so uneasily expecting that very likely he had behaved with less prudence than he might have done.
"In what hotel were you employed?"
Carl sank his head and did not reply. That was the last question he was prepared to answer. It simply must not happen for him to be escorted by a policeman to the Hotel Occidental again, to start investigations there into which his friends and enemies would all be drawn, to have the manageress's wavering faith in him completely undermined, should the boy whom she thought was in the Pensionbrenner turn up in the custody of a policeman, in his shirt sleeves, without the card she had given him, while the head waiter would probably nod comprehendingly, and the head porter mention the hand of God which had at last caught the evildoer.
"He was employed in the Hotel Occidental," said Delmarsh, stepping over the policeman.
"No," shouted Carl, stamping his foot. "That isn't true."
Delmarsh surveyed him with his lips pursed in mockery, as if there were many things he could divulge. Among the children, Carl's unexpected agitation produced great excitement, and they lined up beside Delmarsh to get a better look at Carl. Robinson had stuck his head completely out of the car. He was so intent that he did not move except for an occasional flicker of the eyelids. The boys on the doorstep clapped his hands with delight. The woman beside him gave him a nudge with her elbow to keep him quiet. The porters in the courtyard had just stopped for breakfast and appeared in a bunch with great cans of black coffee, which they kept stirring with long rolls of bread. Several sat down on the edge of the pavement, and they all gulped down their coffee very loudly.
"You know this lad?" the policeman asked Delmarsh.
"Better than I have a mind to," said Delmarsh. "I have done him much kindness in my time, and he gave me little thanks for it, as you can probably imagine, even after the short encounter you've had with him."
"Yes," said the policeman. "He seems to be a hardened young rascal."
"He is all that," said Delmarsh. "But even that isn't the worst thing about him."
"Is that so?" said the policeman.
"Oh,"
said Delmarsh, who was now warming to his theme and swinging his dressing gown to and fro with his hands in the pockets.
"He's a fine bird, this fellow. I and my friend there in the car once picked him up when we were down and out. He had no idea at that time of American conditions. He had just come from Europe, where they had no use for him either. Well, we took him with us, so let him live with us, explain things to him, and try to get him a job, thinking, in spite of everything, that we'd make a decent human being out of him. In the end, he did the disappearing trick one night, and simply vanished, and in circumstances I'd rather not mention right now."
"Is that true or not?" asked Delmarsh in conclusion, plucking at Carl's shirt sleeve.
"Back, you children!"
shouted the policeman, for the children had pressed forward so far that Delmarsh had almost stumbled over one of them. Meanwhile, the porters, discovering that this cross-examination was more interesting than they had suspected, began to pay some heed to it, and gathered in a little close ring behind Carl, so that he could not retreat even by a step, and had to suffer, too, at his very ear the incessant chatter of these same porters, who babbled rather than spoke in a quiet, incomprehensible jargon which was perhaps broken English interspersed with Slavonic words.
"Thanks for the information," said the policeman,
saluting Delmarsh.
"In any case, I'll take him with me and hand him back to the Hotel Occidental."
But Delmarsh said,
"May I ask a favor of you to leave the boy with me for the time being? I have some business to settle with him. I promise that I'll personally take him back to the hotel afterwards."
"I can't do that," said the policeman.
Delmarsh said, "Here is my card," and handed him the card. The policeman looked at it respectfully, but said with a polite smile,
"No, it can't be done."
Much as Carl had been on his guard against Delmarsh hitherto, he saw in him now his only possible salvation. The way he was haggling with the policeman was certainly suspicious, but in any case, Delmarsh would be more easily induced than the policeman not to deliver him to the hotel, and even if he were brought back to the hotel by Delmarsh, he would not nearly be as bad as to be escorted there by a policeman. For the moment, of course, he must not let it be seen that he really wanted to stay with Delmarsh, or all was lost. And with an uneasy feeling, he watched the policeman's hand, which might rise at any moment to seize him.
"I must at least find out why he was suddenly dismissed," said the policeman at last.
while Delmarsh looked away with an offended air and twisted the card between his fingertips.
"But he isn't dismissed at all," cried Robinson to everyone's surprise,
leaning out of the taxi as far as he could reach, with one hand on the driver's shoulder.
"Far from it. He has a very good job there. He's the head boy in the dormitory, and can take anyone in there that he likes. Only he's terribly busy, and if you want to ask him for anything, you have to wait for a long time. He's always in conference with the head waiter and the manageress. His post is a confidential one. He's certainly not dismissed. I don't know why he said he was. How can he be dismissed? I got badly hurt in the hotel, and he had instructions to take me home. And since he wasn't wearing his jacket at the time, he just came without it. I couldn't wait until he fetched his jacket."
"Well, now," said Delmarsh, spreading out his arms in a tone which reproached the policeman for his lack of discernment, and these two words of his seemed to bring an incontestable clarity into the vagueness of Robinson's statement.
"But is this true?" asked the policeman, already weakening. "And if it is true, why does the boy give out that he is dismissed?"
"You'd better tell him," said Delmarsh.
Carr looked at the policeman whose task it was to keep order here among strangers, thinking only of their own advantage, and he had some intuition of the man's difficulties. That made him unwilling to tell a lie, and so he kept his hands tightly clasped behind his back. In the house door, an overseer appeared and clapped his hands as a signal that the porter should go back to work again. They shook the grounds out of their coffee cans and, falling silent, drifted reluctantly through the doorway.
"We'll never come to a conclusion this way,"
said the policeman, and he made to seize Carl by the arm. Carl involuntarily recoiled a little, became conscious of the free space at his back which the porter's departure had left open, turned about, and with a few great bounds for a start, set off at full speed. The children let out a single yell, and with outstretched arms ran a few steps along with him.
"Stop him!"
the policeman shouted down the long, almost empty street, and shouting this cry at regular intervals, set out after Carl at an easy run which showed both great strength and practice. It was lucky for Carl that the chase took place in a working-class quarter. The workers had no liking for the authorities. Carl stuck to the middle of the road because there were fewer obstacles there, and he saw occasional workers calmly halting on the pavement to watch him while the policeman shouted,
"Stop him!"
and kept pointing his baton at him as he ran a parallel course, keeping shrewdly to the smooth pavement. Carl had very little hope, and almost lost that altogether when the policeman, as they were nearing some cross streets where they were sure to be police patrols, began to blow really deafening blasts on his whistle. Carl's only advantage was his light attire. He flew, or rather plunged, down the street, which sloped more and more steeply. But confused by his lack of sleep, he often made useless bounds, too high in the air, and a vain waste of precious time. Besides, the policeman had his objective before his eyes and had no time to think, whereas Carl had to think first and attend to his running only in the intervals between weighing possibilities and making decisions. His plan, a somewhat desperate one, was to avoid the cross streets for the time being, since he did not know what they concealed. Perhaps, for instance, he might run straight into a police station. He wanted, as long as possible, to keep to this main thoroughfare, which he could survey from end to end, since it did not terminate until far below, in a bridge vanishing suddenly into a haze of mist and sunshine in midair. Acting on this decision, he was just putting on a faster spurt, so as to pass the first cross street in a flash, when he saw not very far in front of him a policeman lurking watchfully by the dark wall of a house in shadow, ready to spring out on him at the right moment. There was nothing for it but to turn into the cross street, and when from that very street someone gently called him by name, he thought it was a delusion at first, for there had been a ringing in his ears all the time. He hesitated no longer and made an abrupt turn, to take the police as much as possible by surprise, swinging round at a right angle on one foot into the cross street. He had taken only two strides. He had already forgotten that someone had called his name, for the second policeman was now blowing his whistle too, obviously fresh and unwinded, and distant pedestrians ahead of him in the cross street seemed to be quickening their steps, when an arm darting out from a little doorway seized him, and he was drawn into a dark entry, while a voice said, "Don't move." It was Delmarsh, quite out of breath, his face flushed, his hair sticking damply to his head. He was clad only in his shirt and drawers, his dressing gown tucked under his arm. The door, which was not a main door, but only an inconspicuous side door, he shut and locked at once.
"Wait a minute,"
he said, leaning against the wall and breathing heavily with his head thrown back. Carl, almost lying in his arms and hardly knowing what he was doing, pressed his face against his breast.
"There they go,"
said Delmarsh, listening intently and pointing with his finger at the door. The two policemen were really running past, their feet ringing in the empty street like the striking of steel against stone.
"You've been fairly put through it," said Delmarsh to Carl,
who was still panting for breath and could not bring out a word. Delmarsh laid him cautiously on the floor, knelt down beside him, passed a hand several times over his brow, and regarded him.
"I am all right now," said Carl, painfully getting up. "Then let's go," said Delmarsh,
who had put on his dressing gown again, and he pushed Carl, whose head still drooped with weariness, before him.
"You say you're tired," he said. "You had the whole street to career about in like a horse, but I had to double through these accursed passages and courtyards. It's a good thing that I'm a bit of a runner, too."
In his pride, he gave Carl a mighty thump on the back.
"A race with a policeman like this now and then is good practice." "I was dog-tired before I began running," said Carl. "There's no excuse for bad running," said Delmarsh. "If it hadn't been for me, they would have nabbed you long since."
"I think so, too," said Carl.
"I am much obliged to you."
"No doubt of that," said Delmarsh. They went through a long and narrow ground-floor lobby, which was paved with dark, smooth flagstones. Here and there, to right and left, a staircase opened out, or a passage giving on a more spacious hallway. Scarcely any grown people were to be seen, but children were playing on the empty stairs. Beside a stair railing, a little girl was standing weeping so hard that her whole face glistened with tears. As soon as she caught sight of Delmarsh, she rushed up the stairs, gasping for air, her mouth wide open, and was not reassured until she was quite high up, after looking over her shoulder time and again to make certain that no one was chasing her, or likely to chase her.
"I ran her down a minute ago," said Delmarsh, laughing,
and he flourished his fist at her, whereupon she rushed up still further, screaming. The courtyards they threaded were also almost completely forsaken. An occasional porter pushed a two-wheeled handbarrow before him. A woman was filling a bucket with water at a pump. A postman was quietly making his round. An old man with a white mustache sat before a glass door, smoking a pipe with his legs crossed. Crates were being unloaded before a dispatch agency, while the idle horses imperturbably turned their heads from side to side, and a man in overalls supervised the proceedings with a paper in his hand. Behind the open window of an office, a clerk, sitting at his desk, raised his head and looked thoughtfully out just as Carl and Delmarsh went past.
"This is as quiet a place as you could wish for," said Delmarsh. "In the evening, it's pretty noisy for an hour or two, but all day long, it's ideal."
Carl nodded. It seemed a good deal too quiet for him.
"I couldn't live anywhere else," said Delmarsh, "for Brunelda simply cannot stand any noise. Do you know Brunelda? Well, you'll soon see her. Take my advice anyhow, and keep as quiet as you can."
When they reached the stairway which led up to Delmarsh's flat, the taxi had already gone, and the boy with the half-eaten nose announced, without showing any surprise at Carl's reappearance, that he had lugged Robinson upstairs. Delmarsh only nodded to him, as if he were a servant who had merely done his duty, and then drew Carl, who hesitated a moment and gazed out the sunny street, up the stairs with him.
"We'll soon be there," said Delmarsh
several times during the ascent, but his prophecy was tardy in fulfilling itself, for there was always another stair ahead of them, with a barely perceptible change in direction. Once Carl actually had to stop, not from weariness, but from helplessness in the face of such a length of stairs.
"The flat's very high up," said Delmarsh, as they went on, "but that has its advantages, too. We're not tempted to go out much. We lounge about in our dressing gowns all day. It's very comfortable. Of course, no visitors ever come up so far either."
And what visitors could they have? Thought Carl. At last, on a landing, they caught sight of Robinson outside a closed door, and now they had arrived. The stairs were not at an end yet, but went on further in the semi-darkness without any indication that an end was even in sight.
"I thought so," said Robinson in a muted voice, as if he were still suffering pain. Delmarsh has brought him. Rossman, where would you be without Delmarsh?
Robinson was standing in his underclothes, scantily wrapped in the small blanket he had been given at the Hotel Occidental. There was no visible reason why he did not go into the flat instead of standing here as a laughingstock for any chance passerby.
Is he asleep? Asked Delmarsh.
I don't think so, said Robinson, but I thought it better to wait till you came.
We must see first whether she is sleeping, said Delmarsh, bending down to the keyhole.
After he had peered through it a long time, turning his head this way and that, he got up and said,
I can't see her clearly. The curtain's drawn. She's sitting on the couch, but she may be asleep.
Why, is she ill? Asked Carl, for Delmarsh was standing there as if at a loss for advice. But he retorted in a sharp enough voice,
Ill?
He doesn't know her, said Robinson in extenuation.
A few doors further on, two women stepped out into the passage. They wiped their hands on their aprons, eyeing Delmarsh and Robinson, and seemed to be talking about them. A young girl with gleaming fair hair bounded out of a door and squeezed between the two women, hanging on to their arms.
These are disgusting women, said Delmarsh,
lowering his voice, it was evident, only out of consideration for the slumbering Brunelda.
Sooner or later I'll report them to the police, and then I'll be rid of them for years. Don't look their way.
And he snapped at Carl. But Carl had not seen any harm in looking at the women, since in any case he had to stand in the passage waiting for Brunelda to waken, and he shook his head angrily, as if he refused to take any admonitions from Delmarsh, and he had just begun walking towards the women to make his meaning clearer when Robinson caught him by the sleeve with the words,
Rossman, take care!
While Delmarsh, already exasperated, was roused to such a fury by a loud burst of laughter from the girl that, whirling his arms and legs, he made a great spring at the women, who vanished into their doors as if they had been blown away.
That's how I often have to clear the passages, remarked Delmarsh,
strolling back again. Then he remembered that Carl had been refractory and said,
But I expect very different behavior from you, or else you'll be likely to be coming up against me.
Then from the room a gentle voice queried in a tired tone,
Is that Delmarsh?
Yes,
answered Delmarsh, looking tenderly at the door.
May we come in?
Oh, yes,
was the answer, and after casting one more glance at the two standing behind him, Delmarsh slowly opened the door. They stepped into complete darkness. The curtain before the balcony door, there was no window, was completely drawn and let very little light through, but the fact that the room was crammed with furniture and clothes hanging everywhere contributed greatly to make it darker. The air was musty and one could literally smell the dust which had gathered here in corners, apparently beyond the reach of any hand. The first things that Carl noticed on entering were three trunks set just behind one another. On the couch was lying the woman who had been looking down earlier from the balcony. The red gown had got rumpled a little beneath her and hung in a great peak to the floor. Her legs could be seen almost as far as the knee. She was wearing thick white woolen stockings. She had no shoes.
How hot is it, Delmarsh?
She said, turning her face from the wall and languidly extending her hand in the direction of Delmarsh, who seized it and kissed it. Carl could only see her double chin, which rolled in sympathy with the turning of her head.
Would you like me to draw open the curtain? Asked Delmarsh. Oh, not that, she said as if in despair, shutting her eyes. That would only make it worse.
Carl had gone up to the foot of the couch so as to see the woman better. He was surprised at her lamentations, for the heat was nothing out of the common.
Wait, I'll make you a little more comfortable, said Delmarsh anxiously,
and he undid a few buttons at her neck and pulled her dress open at the throat so that part of her breast was laid bare and the soft yellowish lace border of her chemise appeared.
Who is that?
Said the woman suddenly, pointing a finger at Carl.
Why does he stare at me so hard?
You're being a great help, aren't you?
Said Delmarsh, pushing Carl aside, while he reassured the woman with the words,
It is only the boys that I have brought with me to attend to you.
But I don't want anyone, she cried. Why do you bring strange people into the house?
But you've always been asking for someone to attend to you, said Delmarsh,
kneeling down on the floor, for there was no room whatever on the couch beside Brunelda, in spite of its great breadth.
"Aha, Delmarsh," she said. "You don't understand me. You don't understand me at all."
"Then all right, I don't understand you," said Delmarsh, taking her face between his hands. "But it doesn't really matter. He can go at once if you like."
"Since he is here, he can stay," she said now. And tired as he was, Carl felt so grateful for these words, though they probably were not kindly meant,
that still vaguely thinking of those endless stairs which he might have had to descend again, he stepped over Robinson, now peacefully asleep on his blanket, and said, in spite of Delmarsh's angry gesticulations,
"I thank you anyway for letting me stay here a little longer. I've had no sleep for 24 hours, and I've done a lot of things and been rather upset. I'm terribly tired. I hardly know where I am. But after I've slept an hour or two, you can pack me straight off, and I'll go gladly."
"You can stay here as long as you like," said the woman, adding ironically, "we have more than enough room here, as you see."
"Then you better go," said Delmarsh. "We haven't any use for you."
"No, let him stay," said the woman, this time in earnest, and Delmarsh said to Carl, as if in obedience to her words,
"Well, then, go and lie down somewhere."
"He can lie down on the curtains, but he must take off his shoes to keep from tearing them."
Delmarsh showed Carl the place she meant. Between the door and the three trunks, a great pile of the most multifarious window curtains had been flung. Had they all been methodically folded, with the heavy ones below and the light ones on top, and had the curtain rods and wooden rings scattered through the pile been taken out, they might have actually made a tolerable couch. But as it was, they made a tottering, unstable heap on which, however, Carl laid down at once, for he was too tired to make any particular preparations for sleeping, and had also to guard against standing on too much ceremony with his host and hostess. He had almost fallen into a genuine sleep when he heard a loud cry and started up to see Brunelda sitting erect on the couch, opening her arms wide and flinging them round Delmarsh, who was kneeling before her. Carl, shocked at the sight, lay back again and curled up among the curtains to continue his sleep. That he would not be able to endure this place for 2 days seemed clear enough to him. Yet it was all the more necessary to have a thorough sleep to begin with, so that he might have his wits about him, and be able to decide quickly on the right course of action. But Brunelda had been aware of Carl's eyes, big with fatigue, which had startled her once already, and she cried,
"Delmarsh, I can't bear this heat. I'm burning. I must take off my clothes. I must have a bath. Send the two of them out of the room, wherever you like, into the passage, onto the balcony, so long as they are out of my sight. Here I am in my own home, and yet I can't get any peace. If I were only alone with you, Delmarsh. Oh, God, they're still here. Look at that shameless Robinson sprawling about in his underclothes in the presence of a lady. And look at that boy, that stranger who has just been staring savagely at me. How he is pretending to lie down again to fool me. Turn them out, Delmarsh. They're a burden on me. They're a weight on my breast. If I die now, it'll be their fault."
"Out you get at once. Out of here,"
said Delmarsh, advancing on Robinson and stirring him up with one foot, which he put on his chest. Then he shouted to Carl,
"Rossman, get up. Out of the balcony, both of you. And it'll be your funeral if you come in here before you're called. Now look sleepy, Robinson."
At this, he kicked Robinson more violently.
"And, Rossman, look out, or I'll come and attend to you too."
And he clapped his hands loudly twice.
"How long you're taking," cried Brunelda from the sofa. She had spread her legs wide where she sat, so as to get more room for her disproportionately fat body.
Only with the greatest effort, gasping and frequently pausing to recover her breath, could she bend far enough forward to catch hold of her stockings at the top and pull them down a little. She could not possibly take off her own clothes. Delmarsh would have to do that, and she was now impatiently waiting for him. Quite dazed with weariness, Carl crept down from the heap of curtains and trailed slowly to the balcony door. A piece of curtain material had wrapped itself around his foot, and he dragged it indifferently with him. In his distraction, he actually said as he passed Brunelda,
"I wish you good night,"
and he wandered past Delmarsh, who was drawing aside the curtain of the balcony door, and went out onto the balcony.
Immediately behind him came Robinson, who seemed to be equally sleep-sodden, for he was muttering to himself,
"Always being ill-treated. If Brunelda doesn't come too, I'm not going on to the balcony."
But in spite of this pronouncement, he went out meekly enough on the balcony where, as Carl had already subsided into the easy chair, he immediately bedded himself on the stone floor. When Carl awoke, it was evening. The stars were already out, and behind the tall houses on the other side of the street, the moon was rising. Not until he had surveyed the unknown neighborhood for a little, and taken a few breaths of the cool, reviving air, did Carl realize where he was. How imprudent he had been, how he had neglected all the counsels of the manageress, all Teresa's warnings, all his own fears. Here he was sitting calmly on Delmarche's balcony, where he had slept for half a day, as if Delmarche, his mortal enemy, were not just on the other side of the curtain. Robinson, that lazy good-for-nothing, was sprawling on the floor and tugging him by the foot. He seemed indeed to have wakened him in this manner, for he was saying,
"How can you sleep, Rossman? That's what it is to be young and carefree. How long do you want to go on sleeping? I'll have to let you go on sleeping, but in the first place I'm bored with lying on the floor, and in the second place I'm terribly hungry. Come on, get up for a minute. I've got something hidden under your chair, something to eat, and I want to get it out. I'll give you some, too."
And Carl, getting up, looked on while Robinson, without getting up, rolled over on his belly and reached under the chair to pull out a sort of silver salver such as used for holding visiting cards. On the salver lay one half of a quite black sausage, a few thin cigarettes, an open sardine tin still nearly full and dripping with oil, and a number of sweets, most of them squashed into a mass. Then appeared a big hunk of bread and a kind of perfume bottle, which seemed to contain something else other than perfume. However, for Robinson displayed it with particular satisfaction, licking his lips and looking up at Carl.
"You see, Rossman,"
said Robinson, while he devoured sardine after sardine and now and then wiped the oil off his hands with a woolen scarf which Brunelda had apparently forgotten on the balcony.
"You see, Rossman, that's what you need to do if you don't want to starve. I tell you, I'm just kicked out of the way, and if you're always treated like a dog, you begin to think you're actually one. A good thing you're here, Rossman. I have at least someone to talk to. Nobody in the building speaks to me. They hate us, and all because of Brunelda. She's a marvelous woman, of course. I say..."
And he gave Carl a sign to bend down so that he might whisper to him.
"I once saw her naked. Oh."
And in the memory of that pleasure, he began to pinch and slap Carl's leg until Carl shouted,
"Robinson, you're mad!"
and forcibly pushed his hand away.
"You're still only a child, Rossman,"
said Robinson, and from under his shirt he pulled out a dagger that he wore on a cord round his neck, removed the sheath, and began to slice up the hard sausage.
"You've still got a lot to learn, but you've come to the right place to learn things. Do sit down. Won't you have something to eat, too? Well, maybe you'll get an appetite watching me. You don't want to drink either? So you don't want anything at all, and you're not much inclined to talk either. But I don't care who's on the balcony with me so long as there's somebody, for I'm often out on the balcony. It's great fun for Brunelda. She only has to get an idea in her head that she's too cold, that she's too hot, that she wants to sleep, that she wants to comb her hair, that she wants to loosen her corset, that she wants to put it on, and then she has me sent to the balcony. Sometimes she actually does what she says, but mostly she just lies on the couch the same as before and never moves. I sometimes used to draw the curtain a little and peep through, but once Delmarche, I know quite well that he didn't want to do it and only did it because Brunelda told him to. But once Delmarche, on one of these occasions, struck me across the face several times with the whip. Can you see the marks? And since then, I haven't dared to peep again. And so I just lie here on the balcony and have nothing to do but eat. The night before last, I lay up here alone all evening. I still had on the fine clothes which I had and the bad luck to lose in your hotel. The swine, tearing a man's expensive clothes off his back. Well, as I lay alone and looked down through the railings, everything seemed so miserable that I began to blubber. but it just happened, without my noticing it, that Brunelda had come out here in her red gown. That suits her far the best of them all. And she looked at me for a little while and said, "Robinson, what are you crying for?" And she lifted up her skirt and wiped my eyes with a hem. Who knows what more she might have done if Delmarche hadn't called her and she hadn't gone back into the room again at once. I thought, of course, that it was my turn next, and I asked through the curtain if I couldn't come in. And what do you think Brunelda said? "No," she said. And, "What are you thinking of?" said she.
"But why do you stay here if they treat you like that?" asked Carl.
"Excuse me, Rossman, but that's a stupid question," replied Robinson. "You'll stay here, too, even if they treat you still worse. Besides, they don't treat me so very badly."
"No," said Carl. "I'm certainly going away, in this very evening, if possible. I'm not going to stay with you."
"And how, for instance, will you manage to get away tonight?"
asked Robinson, who was digging out the soft inside of the loaf and carefully dipping it into the oil in the sardine box.
"How are you going to leave when you mustn't even go into the room?"
"And why shouldn't I go into the room?"
"Because until we're rung for, we can't go in,"
said Robinson, opening his mouth to its full extent and devouring the oily bread, while in the hollow of one hand he caught the oil that dripped from it, making a kind of reservoir which he dipped the rest of the bread from time to time.
"Things are much stricter now. At first there was only a thin curtain. You couldn't actually see through it, but in the evenings you could watch their shadows on it. But Brunelda didn't like that. So I had to turn one of her evening cloaks into a curtain and hang it up instead of the old one. Now you can see nothing at all. Then at one time I could always ask whether I might go in, and they used to say yes or no accordingly. But I suppose I took too much advantage of that and asked once too often. Brunelda couldn't bear it, and although she's so fat, she's very delicate. She often has headaches and almost always gout in her legs. And so it was decided that I mustn't ask any more, but that I could go in whenever the table bell was rung. That rings so loudly that it can waken even me out of my sleep. I once had a cat out here to cheer me up, but she was so scared at the bell that she ran away and never came back. It hasn't rung today yet, you see, for when it does ring, I'm not only allowed to go in, I have to go in, and when such a long time goes by without ringing, it can take a good while before the bell rings again.
Yes, said Carl, but what applies to you needn't apply to me at all. Besides, that kind of thing only applies to those who put up with it.
But,
cried Robinson,
why shouldn't it apply to you as well? Of course it applies to you too. You better stay here quietly with me until the bell rings. Then, of course, you can at least try to get away.
Is that what really keeps you here? Simply Delmarche is your friend, or rather was your friend. Do you call this a life? Wouldn't it be better for you in Butterford, where you wanted to go first, or even in California, where you had friends?
Well, said Robinson, nobody could have told that this was going to happen.
And before continuing, he said,
to your good health, my dear Rossman,
and took a long pull at the perfume bottle.
We were hard up against it at that time when you let us down so meanly. We could get no work at all for the first day or two. Besides, Delmarche didn't want work. He could easily have got it, but he always sent me to look for it instead, and I never have any luck. He just loafed around, but by the evening all he brought back with him was a lady's handbag. It was fine enough, made of pearls. He gave it to Brunelda later, but there was almost nothing in it. He said we'd better try begging at the doors. You can always pick up something or the other that way. So we went begging, and I sang in front of the houses to make it look better. And it was just like Delmarche's luck, for we had only been a minute or two at the second door, a very grand flat on the ground floor, and sung a couple of songs to the cook and the butler, when the lady the flat belonged to, Brunelda herself, came up the front steps. Maybe she was too tightly laced. Anyhow, she couldn't get up to the top of these steps. But how lovely she looked, Rossman. She was wearing a white dress with a red sunshade. You felt you could eat her. You felt you could just drink her up. God, she was lovely. What a woman. Tell me yourself, how can such a woman be possible? Of course the cook and the butler rushed down to her at once and almost carried her up. We stood on either side of the door and raised our hats as people do here. She stopped for a little while, but she hadn't quite got her breath back, and I don't know how it actually happened. I was so hungry I didn't know quite what I was doing, and close at hand she was even handsomer. So broad and yet so firm everywhere because of all the special stays she had on. I can let you see them in the trunk. Well, I couldn't help touching her back, but quite lightly, you know. Just a touch. Of course, it's a shocking thing for a beggar to touch a rich lady. I just touched her. But after all, I did touch her. Who knows where it might have ended if Delmarsh hadn't given me a clip on the ear, and such a clip that both my hands flew to my own face.
"What things to do," said Carl, quite absorbed in the story, and he sat down on the floor. "So that was Brunelda?"
"Yes," said Robinson. "That was Brunelda."
"Didn't you say she was a singer?" asked Carl.
"Certainly, she is a singer. And a great singer," replied Robinson,
who was rolling a sticky mass of sweet meats on his tongue, and now and then pushing back with his finger some piece that had got crowded out of his mouth.
"Of course, we didn't know that at the time. We only saw that she was rich and a very fine lady. She behaved as if nothing had happened, and perhaps she hadn't felt anything, for I had touched her really only with the tips of my fingers. But she kept looking at Delmarsh, who stared back straight into her eyes. He usually hits it off like that. Then she said to him, 'Come inside for a little,' and pointed with her sunshade into the house, and Delmarsh had to go in front of her. Then the two of them went in, and the servants shut the door after them. As for me, I was left forgotten outside, and since I thought it wouldn't be for very long, I sat down on the steps to wait for Delmarsh. But instead of Delmarsh, the butler came out bringing me a whole bowl of soup. 'A compliment from Delmarsh,' I told myself. The man stood beside me for a time while I ate and told me some things about Brunelda, and then I saw how important this visit might be for us, for Brunelda had divorced her husband, was very wealthy, and completely independent. Her ex-husband, a cocoa manufacturer, was still in love with her, to be sure, but she refused to have anything whatever to do with him. He often called the flat, always dressed in great style as if he was going to a wedding. That's true, word for word. I know the man myself, but in spite of the huge tips he got, the butler never dared to ask Brunelda whether she would receive her husband, for he had asked her before once or twice. But she has always picked up anything she had handy and thrown it at his head. Once she even flung her big hot water bottle at him and knocked out one of his front teeth. Yes, Rossman, you may well stare."
"How do you come to know the husband?" asked Carl.
"He often comes up here," said Robinson.
"Here?" In his astonishment, Carl struck the floor lightly with his hand.
"You may be very well surprised," Robinson went on. "I was surprised myself when the butler stood there telling me all this. Just think, whenever Brunelda was out, the husband always asked the butler to take him to her room, and he always took away some trifle or other as a keepsake, and left something rare and expensive for Brunelda in return, and strictly forbade the butler to say who had left it. But once, the servant swears it, and I believe it, that when he left an absolutely priceless piece of porcelain, Brunelda must have recognized it somehow, for she flung it on the floor at once, stamped upon it, spat on it, and did other things to it as well, so that the servant could hardly carry it away for disgust.
But what had her husband done to her? Asked Carl.
I don't really know, said Robinson. But I think it wasn't anything very serious. At least he himself doesn't know. I have often talked to him about it. I have an appointment with him every day at the corner of the street over there. If I can come, I have always to tell him the latest news. If I can't come, he waits for half an hour and then goes away again. It was a nice extra for me at first, for he paid like a gentleman for the news. But after Del Marsh came to know of it, I had to hand over the money to him, and so I don't go down there so often now.
But what's the man after? Asked Carl. What on earth is he after? He surely knows that she doesn't want him.
Yeah,
sighed Robinson, lighting a cigarette and fanning the smoke high in the air with great sweeps of his arm. Then he seemed to change his attitude and said,
What does that matter to me? All I know is that he would give a lot of money to be able to lie here on the balcony like us.
Carl got up, leaned against the railing, and looked down into the street. The moon was already visible, but its light did not yet penetrate into the depths of the street. Though it had been so empty during the day, the street was now crowded with people. Particularly before the house doors, they were all drifting along slowly and heavily, the shirt sleeves of the men and the light dresses of the women standing out faintly against the darkness. They were all bareheaded. The various balconies round about were now fully occupied. Whole families were sitting there by the light of electric lamps, either round small tables, if the balcony were big enough, or a single row of armchairs, or merely sticking their heads out of their living rooms. The men sat at ease with their legs stretched out, their feet between the bars of the railing, reading newspapers which extended almost to the floor, or playing cards, apparently without speaking, but to the accompaniment of loud bangs on the table. The women's laps were full of sewing work, and they had nothing but a brief glance now and then for their surroundings or the street below. A fair, delicate woman on the next balcony kept on yawning, turning her eyes up and raising to her mouth a piece of underwear which she was mending. Even on the smallest balconies, the children managed to chase each other round and make themselves a nuisance to their parents.
Inside many of the rooms, gramophones could be heard grinding out songs or orchestral music. Nobody paid any particular attention to this music, except that now and then the father of a family would give a sign and someone would hurry into the room to put on a new record. At some of the windows could be seen loving couples standing quite motionless. One of these couples was standing at a window opposite. The young man had his arms around the girl and was squeezing her waist. "Do you know any of your neighbors here?" Carl asked Robinson, who had now also got to his feet, and feeling cold had huddled himself into Brunelda's wrap as well as his blanket.
"Hardly any of them. That's the worst of my situation," said Robinson, and he pulled Carl closer as to whisper in his ear. "Or else I wouldn't have much to complain about at the moment. Brunelda has sold everything she had for the sake of Del Marsh, and has moved with all she possesses into this suburban flat, in order to devote herself entirely to him with nobody to disturb her. Besides, that was what Del Marsh wanted, too."
"And she has dismissed her servants?" asked Carl.
"That's so," said Robinson. "Where could you find accommodation for servants here? Servants like that expect the best of everything. In Brunelda's old flat, Del Marsh once simply kicked one of these pampered creatures out of the room. He just went on kicking him until the man was outside. The other servants, of course, took the man's side and staged a row before the door. Then Del Marsh went out. I wasn't a servant then, but a friend of my family. Yet I was outside among the servants all the same, and asked, 'What do you want?' The oldest servant, a man called Isidore, told him, 'You have nothing to do with us. We are engaged by the mistress.' I suppose you noticed that they had a great respect for Brunelda. But Brunelda paid no attention to them and ran up to Del Marsh. She wasn't so heavy then as she is now, and she embraced and kissed him before all of them and called him Darling Del Marsh. After then, she said, 'Now send these fools away.' Fools! That's what she called the servants. You can imagine the expression on their faces. Then Brunelda took Del Marsh's hand and drew it down to the purse she wore at her belt. Delmarsh put it in his hand and began to pay off the servants. Brunelda did nothing but stand there with the open purse at her waist. Delmarsh had to put his hand in over and over again, for he paid out the money without counting it and without checking their claims. At last he said, "Since you won't have anything to do with me, I'll only say in Brunelda's name, get out this instant." So they were dismissed. There were some legal proceedings afterwards. Delmarsh had actually to go to court once, but I don't know much more about it, except that as soon as the servants had gone, Delmarsh said to Brunelda, "So now you have no servants." And she said, "But there's still Robinson." So Delmarsh clapped me on the shoulder and said, "Very well then, you'll be our servant." And then Brunelda patted me on the cheek. "If you ever get a chance, Rossman, you should get her to pat you on the cheek sometime. You'd be surprised how lovely it feels."
"So you've turned into Delmarsh's servant, have you?" said Carl, summing up. Robinson heard the pity in his voice and answered,
"I may be a servant, but very few people know about it. You see, you didn't know it yourself, although you've been here quite a while. Why, you saw how I was dressed last night in the hotel. I had on the finest of fine clothes. Are servants dressed like that? The only thing is that I can't leave here very often. I must always be at hand. There's always something to do in the flat. One man isn't really enough for all the work. You may have noticed that we have a lot of things standing about in the room. What we couldn't sell at the removal we took with us here. Of course, it would have been given away, but Brunelda gives nothing away. You can imagine what it meant to carry these things up the stairs."
"Robinson, did you carry all these things up here?" said Carl.
"Why, who else was there to do it?"
said Robinson.
"I had a man to help me, but he was a lazy rascal. I had to do most of the work alone. Brunelda stood down below beside the man. Delmarsh decided up here where the things were to be put, and I had to keep rushing up and down. That went on for 2 days. A long time, wasn't it? You got no idea whatever how many things are in that room. All the trunks are full, and behind the trunks, the whole place is crammed to the very roof. If they had to hire a few men for the transport, everything would soon have been finished, but Brunelda wouldn't trust it to anyone but me. That was flattering, of course, but I ruined my health for life during those 2 days, and what else did I have except my health? Whenever I try to do the least thing, I have pains here and here and here. Do you think these boys in the hotel, these young jumping jacks, for that's what they all are, would have even gotten the better of me if I'd been in good health? But broken down as I may be, I'll never say a word to Delmarsh or Brunelda. I'll work for as long as I can, and when I can't do it any longer, I'll just lie down and die. And then they'll find out too late that I was really ill and went on working and worked myself to death in their service. Oh, Rossman,"
he ended, drawing his eyes on Carl's shirt sleeve. After a while, he said,
"Aren't you cold, standing there in your shirt?"
"Go on, Robinson," said Carl. "You're always blubbering. I don't believe you're so ill as all that. You look healthy enough, but lying about on the balcony all the time, you fancy all sorts of things. You may have an occasional pain in the chest. So have I. So has everybody. If everybody blubbered like you about such trifles, there would be nothing but blubbering on all these balconies."
"I know better," said Robinson, wiping his eyes with the corner of his blanket. "The student staying next door with the landlady who cooks for us said to me a little time ago when I brought back the dishes, 'Look here, Robinson, you're ill, aren't you?' I'm not supposed to talk to these people, and so I simply set down the dishes and started to go away. Then he came right up to me and said, 'Listen, man, don't push things too far. You're a sick man.' 'All right, then. What am I to do about it?' I asked him. 'That's your business,' he said, and turned away. The others sitting at the table just laughed. They're all our enemies round here, and so I thought I'd better quit."
"So you believe anyone who makes you a fool? You don't believe anyone who means to do well by you?"
"But I must surely know how I feel,
exclaimed Robinson indignantly, beginning to cry again almost at once.
"You don't know what's really wrong with you. You should only find some decent work for yourself instead of being Delmarsh's servant. So far I can tell from your account of it, and from what I've seen myself, this isn't service here, it's slavery. Nobody could endure it. I believe you there, but because you're Delmarsh's friend you think you can't leave him. That's nonsense. If he doesn't see what a wretched life you're leading, you can't have the slightest obligation to him."
"So you really think, Rossman, that I would recover my health if I gave up working here?"
"Certainly," said Carl.
"Certainly?"
Robinson asked again. "Quite certainly," said Carl, smiling.
"Then I can begin recovering straight away," said Robinson, looking at Carl.
"How's that?" asked Carl.
"Why, because you are to take over my work here," replied Robinson.
"Who on earth told you that?" asked Carl.
"Oh, it's an old plan. It's been discussed for days. It began with Brunelda scolding me for not keeping the flat clean enough. Of course, I promised to put everything right at once, but, well, that was very difficult. For instance, in my state of health, I can't creep into all the corners to sweep away the dust. It's hardly possible to move in the middle of the room, far less get behind the furniture and piles of stuff. And if the place is to be thoroughly cleaned, the furniture would have to be shifted about. And how could I do that by myself? Besides, it all has to be done very quietly so as not to disturb Brunelda, and she scarcely ever leaves the room. So I promised to give everything a clean-up, but I didn't actually clean it up. When Brunelda noticed that, she told Delmarsh this couldn't go on, and that he would have to take on an assistant. 'I don't want you, Delmarsh,' she said, 'to reproach me at any time for not running the house properly. I can't put any strain upon myself, you know that quite well, and Robinson isn't enough. In the beginning he was fresh and looked after everything, but now he's always tired and sits most of the time in a corner. But a room with so many things in it as ours needs to be kept in order.' So Delmarsh considered how it was to be managed, for, of course, it wouldn't do to take anyone and everyone into such a household as ours, even on trial, since we're all spied on from all sides. But as I was a good friend of yours and had heard from Rennell how you had to slave in the hotel, I suggested your name. Delmarsh agreed at once, although you were so rude to him before, and of course I was very glad to be of some use to you. For this job might have been made for you. You're young, strong, and quick, while I'm no good to anyone. But I must tell you that you're not taken on yet. If Brunelda doesn't like you, that's the end of it. So do your best to be pleasant to her, and I'll see to the rest."
"And what are you going to do if I take on the job?" queried Carl. He felt quite free. He had got over the first alarm which Robinson's announcement had caused him, so Delmarsh meant no worse by him than to turn him into a servant. If he had had more sinister intentions, the babbling Robinson would certainly have blabbed them. But if that was how things stood, Carl saw his way to get clear of the place that very night. No one could be compelled to take a job, and though at first he had been worried in case his dismissal from the hotel would hinder him from getting a suitable, and if possible fairly respectable post quickly enough to keep him from starving, any post at all now seemed good enough compared with this proposal, which repelled him. He would rather be unemployed and destitute than accept it. But he did not even try to make that clear to Robinson, particularly as Robinson's mind was now completely obsessed by the hope of shifting his burdens onto Carl's shoulders.
"To begin with," said Robinson, accompanying the words with a reassuring wave of the hand.
His elbows were planted on the railings.
"I'll explain everything and show you all the things we have. You've had a good education, and I'm sure your handwriting's excellent, so you could make an inventory straight away of all our stuff. Brunelda has been wanting that done for a long time. If the weather's good tomorrow morning, we'll ask Brunelda to sit out on the balcony and we can work quietly in the room without disturbing her. For that must be your first consideration, Rossman. Brunelda mustn't be disturbed. Her hearing's very keen. It's probably because she's a singer that her ears are so sensitive. For instance, say that you're rolling out a keg of brandy, which usually stands behind the trunks. It makes a noise because it's heavy and all sorts of things are lying about on the floor, so that you can't roll it straight out. Brunelda, let us say, is lying quietly on the couch catching flies, which are a great torment to her. You think she's paying no attention to you, and you keep on rolling the keg. She's still lying there quite peacefully, but all at once, just when you're least expecting it and when you're making least noise, she suddenly sits up, bangs with both hands on the couch so that you can't see her for dust. Since we came here, I haven't beaten the dust out of the couch. I really couldn't. She's always lying on it. And begins to yell ferociously, like a man, and goes on yelling for hours. The neighbors have forbidden her to sing, but no one can forbid her to yell. She has to yell, though that doesn't happen often now, for Delmarche and I have grown careful. It was very bad for her, too. Once she fainted. Delmarche was away at the time, and I had to fetch the student from next door who sprinkled some fluid over her out of a big bottle. It did her good, too, but the fluid had an awful smell. Even now you can smell it if you put your nose to the couch. That student is certainly an enemy of ours, like everybody here. You must be on your guard, too, and have nothing to do with any of them.
But I say, Robinson, remarked Carl, this is a heavy program. A fine job that this is that you've recommended me for.
Don't you worry,
said Robinson, shutting his eyes and shaking his head, as if shaking off all Carl's possible worries.
This job has advantages you wouldn't find in any other. You're always in close attendance on a lady like Brunelda. You sometimes sleep in the same room as she does, and, as you can imagine, there's lots of enjoyment to be got out of that. You'll be well paid, there's plenty of money about. I got no wages being a friend to Delmarche, though every time I went out, Brunelda always gave me something. But you, of course, will be paid like any other servant. That's what you are, after all. But the most important thing is that I'll be able to make your job much easier for you. Of course, I wouldn't do anything just at first, to just give myself a chance of getting better. But as soon as I'm even a little better, you can count on me. In any case, I'll do all the waiting on Brunelda, doing her hair, for example, and helping her dress, so far as Delmarche doesn't attend to that. You'll only have to concern yourself with cleaning the room, getting in what we need, and doing the heavy housework.
No, Robinson, said Carl, all this doesn't tempt me.
Don't be a fool, Rossman,
said Robinson, putting his face quite close to Carl's.
Don't throw away this splendid chance. Where will you get another job so quickly? Who knows you? What people do you know? The two of us, both full-grown men with plenty of practical skill and experience, wandered about for weeks without finding work. It isn't easy. In fact, it's damn difficult.
Carl nodded, marveling that Robinson could talk so reasonably. Still, all this advice was beside the point so far as he was concerned. He couldn't stay here. There must be some place for him in the great city. The whole night he knew all the hotels were filled to bursting and the guests needed service, and he had had some training in that. He would slip quickly and unobtrusively into some job or other. Just across the street there was a small restaurant on the ground floor, from which came a rush of music. The main entrance was covered only with a big yellow curtain, which billowed out into the street now and then, as a draft of air caught it. Otherwise, things were much quieter up and down the street. Most of the balconies were dark, only far in the distance a single light was twinkling here and there, but almost as soon as one fixed one's eyes upon it, the people beside it got up and thronged back into the house, while the last man left outside put his hand to the lamp and switched it off after a brief glance at the street.
"It's nightfall already," said Carl to himself. "If I stay here any longer, I'll become one of them." He turned around to pull aside the curtain of the balcony door.
"What are you doing?"
said Robinson, planting himself between Carl and the curtain.
"I'm leaving," said Carl. "Let me go, let me go."
"But surely not going to disturb her," cried Robinson. "What are you thinking of?"
And he threw his arms round Carl's neck, clinging to him with all his weight and twisting his legs round Carl's legs, so that in a trice he had him down on the floor. But among the lift boys, Carl had learned a little fighting, and so he drove his fist against Robinson's chin, not putting out his whole strength to avoid hurting him. Quickly and without any scruple, Robinson punched him in the belly with his knee before beginning to nurse his chin in both hands, and let out such a howl that a man on the next balcony clapped his hands furiously and shouted,
"Silence!"
Carl lay still for a little so as to recover from the pain of Robinson's foul blow. He turned only his head to watch the curtain hanging still and heavy before the room,
which was obviously in darkness. It looked as if no one were in the room now. Perhaps Delmarsh had gone out with Brunilda, and the way was perfectly free. For Robinson, who was behaving exactly like a watchdog, had been finally shaken off. Then, from the far end of the street, there came in a fitful blast the sound of drums and trumpets. The single shouts of individuals in a crowd soon blended into a general roar. Carl turned his head again and saw that all the balconies were once more coming to life. Slowly he got up. He could not stand quite straight, and had to lean heavily against the railing. Down on the pavement, young lads were striding along, waving their caps at the full stretch of their arms and looking back over their shoulders. The middle of the road was still vacant. Some were flourishing tall poles with lanterns on the end of them enveloped in a yellowish smoke. The drummers and the trumpeters, arrayed in broad ranks, were just emerging into the light in such numbers that Carl was amazed, and when he heard the voices behind him, turned round and saw Delmarsh lifting the heavy curtain and Brunilda stepping out of the darkness of the room, in the red gown with a lace scarf around her shoulders and a dark hood over her hair, which was presumably still undressed and only hastily gathered up, for loose ends straggled here and there. In her hand she held a little fan, which she had opened but did not use, keeping it pressed close to her. Carl moved sideways along the railing to make space for the two of them. No one surely would force him to stay here, and even if Delmarsh tried it, Brunilda would let him go at once if he were to ask her. After all, she couldn't stand him. His eyes terrified her. Yet as he took a step toward the door, she noticed it and asked, "Where are you going, boy?" Delmarsh's severe eye held Carl an instant, and Brunilda drew him close to her. "Don't you want to see the procession down there?" she said, pushing him before her to the railing. "Do you know what it's about?" Carl heard her asking behind him, but he flinched in an involuntary but unsuccessful attempt to escape from the pressure of her body. He gazed down sadly at the street, as if the cause of his sadness lay there. For a while Delmarsh stood with crossed arms behind Brunilda. Then he ran into the room and brought her the opera glasses. Down below, the main body of the procession had now come into sight behind the band. On the shoulders of a gigantic man sat a gentleman of whom nothing could be seen at his height, save the faint gleam of a bald crown, over which he was holding a top hat upraised in perpetual greeting. Round about him, great wooden placards were being carried, which, seen from the balcony, looked blankly white. They were obviously intended to make a sloping rampart around the prominent central figure, against which they were literally leaning. But since the bearers were moving on all the time, the wall of placards kept falling into disrepair and seeking to repair itself again. Beyond the ring of placards, so far as one could judge in the darkness, the whole breadth of the street, although only a trifling part of its length, was filled with the gentlemen's supporters, who clapped their hands in rhythm and kept proclaiming in a chanting cadence what seemed to be the gentleman's name, a quite short but incomprehensible name. Single supporters adroitly distributed among the crowd were carrying motor car lamps of enormous power, which they were slowly shown up and down the houses of both sides of the street. At the height where Carl was, the light was not unbearable, but on the lower balconies he could see people hastily putting their hands over their eyes whenever it flashed in their faces. At Brunilda's request, Delmarsh inquired of the people on the next balcony what the meaning of the demonstration was. Carl was somewhat curious to note whether and how they would answer him. And actually, Delmarsh was forced to repeat his question three times before he received an answer. He was already bending threateningly over the railing, and Brunilda had begun to tap with one foot in exasperation at her neighbors, for Carl could feel her knee moving. Finally, some sort of answer was given, but simultaneously everyone on the next balcony, which was packed with people, burst out into loud laughter. At that, Delmarsh yelled a retort so loudly that, if the whole street had not been filled with noise for the moment, all the people round about must have pricked up their ears in astonishment. In any case, it had the effect of making the laughter cease with unnatural abruptness.
"A judge is being elected in our district tomorrow, and the man they are chairing down there is one of the candidates," said Delmarsh quite calmly, returning to Brunilda. "Oh," he went on, caressing Brunilda's shoulder, "we've lost all idea of what's happening in the world."
"Delmarsh," said Brunilda, reverting to her behavior of her neighbors, "how thankful I would be to move out of here, if it wasn't such an effort. But unfortunately I can't face it." And sighing deeply, she kept plucking restlessly and distractedly at Carl's shirt. As unobtrusively as he could, he kept pushing away her plump little hand again and again, which was an easy matter, for Brunilda was not thinking of him. She was occupied with quite other thoughts. But Carl soon forgot her and suffered the weight of her arms on his shoulders.
for the proceedings in the street took up all his attention, at the command of small groups of gesticulating men, who marched just in front of the candidate and whose consultations must have had a particular importance, for one could see attentive faces turned to them from all sides. A halt was abruptly called before the little restaurant. A member of this authoritative group made a signal with his upraised hand which seemed to apply to the crowd and to the candidate as well. The crowd fell silent, and the candidate, who tried several times to stand upright and several times fell back again on the shoulders of his bearer, made a short speech, waving his top hat to and fro at lightning speed. He could be seen quite clearly, for during his speech all the motor car lamps were directed upon him, so that he found himself in the center of a bright star of light. Now, too, one could realize in the interest which the whole street took in the occurrence. On the balconies where supporters of the candidate were packed, the people joined in chanting his name, stretching their hands far over the railings and clapping with machine-like regularity. On the opposition balconies, which were actually in the majority, a howl of retaliation arose, which, however, did not achieve a unified effect, as it came from rival supporters of various candidates. However, all the enemies of the present candidate united in a general catcalling, and even many of the gramophones were set going again. Between the separate balconies, political disputes were being fought out with a violence intensified by the late hour. Many of the people were already in their nightclothes, with overcoats flung over them. The women were enveloped in great dark wraps. The children, with nobody to attend them, climbed dangerously about the railings of the balcony and came swarming more and more out of the dark rooms in which they had been sleeping. Here and there, unrecognizable objects were being flung by particularly heated partisans in the directions of their enemies. Sometimes they reached their mark, but most of them fell down into the street, where they provoked yells of rage. When the noise became too much for the leading man in the procession, the drummers and trumpeters received orders to intervene, and their blaring, long-drawn-out flourish, executed with all the force which they were capable, drowned every human voice up to the very housetops. And then, quite suddenly, almost before one realized it, they would stop, whereupon the crowd in the street, obviously trained for this purpose, at once launched their party song into the momentary general silence. One could see all their mouths wide open in the light of the motor car lamps, until their opponents, coming to their senses again, yelled 10 times as loudly as before from all the balconies and windows, and the party below, after their brief victory, were reduced to complete silence, at least for anyone standing at this height.
"How do you like it, boy?" asked Brunelda, who kept turning and twisting close behind Carl, so as to see as much as possible through her glasses. Carl merely answered with a nod of the head. He noticed out of the corner of his eye that Robinson was busily talking away to Delmarsh, obviously about Carl's intentions, but that Delmarsh seemed to attach no importance to what he said, for with his right arm round Brunelda he kept pushing Robinson aside with his left.
"Wouldn't you like to look through the glasses?" asked Brunelda, tapping Carl on the chest to show that she meant him.
"I can see well enough," said Carl.
"Do try," she said. "You'll see much better."
"I have good eyes," replied Carl. "I can see everything."
He did not feel it as a kindness, but as a nuisance when she put the glasses before his eyes, with the mere words, "Here, you!" uttered melodiously enough but threateningly. And now the glasses were before Carl's eyes, and he could see nothing at all.
"I can't see anything," he said, trying to get away from the glasses, but she held them firmly, and his head, which was pressed against her breast, he could not move backwards nor sideways.
"But you can see now," she said, turning the screw.
"No, I can't see anything," said Carl, and he thought that in spite of himself he had relieved Robinson of his duties after all, for Brunelda's insupportable whims were now being wreaked upon him.
"When on earth are you going to see?"
she said, and turned the screw again. Carl's whole face was now exposed to her heavy breath.
"Now?"
she asked.
"No, no, no!"
cried Carl, although he could actually distinguish everything now, though very vaguely. But at that moment Brunelda thought of something to say to Delmarsh. She held the glasses loosely before Carl's eyes, and without noticing it, he could peep under the glasses at the street. After that, she no longer insisted on having her way and used the glasses for her own pleasure. From the restaurant below, a waiter had emerged, and dashing in and out of the door, took orders from the leaders. One could see him standing on his toes so as to overlook the interior of the establishment and summon as many of the staff as possible. During these preparations for what was obviously a round of free drinks, the candidate never stopped speaking. The man who was carrying him, the giant specifically reserved for him, kept turning round a little after every few sentences, so that the address might reach all sections of the crowd. The candidate maintained a crouching posture most of the time, and tried with backward sweeps of his free hand and the top hat in the other to give special emphasis to his words. But every now and then, at almost regular intervals, the flow of his eloquence proved too much for him. He rose to his full height with outstretched arms. He was no longer addressing a group, but the whole multitude. He spoke to all the people in the houses up to the very top floors, and yet it was perfectly clear that no one could hear him, even in the lowest stories. Indeed, even if they could, nobody would have wanted to hear him, for every window and every balcony was occupied by at least one spouting orator. Meanwhile, several waiters were carrying out of the restaurant a table covered with brimming, winking glasses about the size of a billiard table. The leaders organized the distribution of the drinks, which was achieved in the form of a march past the restaurant. But although the glasses on the table were always filled again, they were not enough for the mob of people, and two relays of barmen had to keep slipping through the crowd on both sides of the table to supply further needs. The candidate had, of course, stopped speaking, and was employing the pause in refreshing his energies. His bearer carried him slowly backward and forwards, sometimes apart from the crowd and the harsh light, and only a few of his closest supporters accompanied him, and threw remarks to him.
"Look at the boy," said Brunelda. "He's so busy staring that he's quite forgotten where he is."
And she took Carl by surprise, turning his face towards her with both hands, so that she was gazing into his eyes. But it lasted only a minute, for Carl shook her hands off at once, and, annoyed that they would not leave him in peace, and also eager to go down to the street and see everything close at hand, tried with all his might to free himself from Brunelda's grip, and said,
"Please, let me go away."
"You'll stay with us," said Delmarche without turning his eyes from the street, merely stretching out his hand to prevent Carl from going.
"Leave him alone," said Brunelda, pushing away Delmarche's hand. "He'll stay all right,"
and she squeezed Carl still more firmly against the railing, so that he would have to struggle with her to get away. And even if he were to free himself, what could he gain by that? Delmarche was standing on his left. Robinson had now moved across to his right. He was literally a prisoner.
"Count yourself lucky that you're not thrown out," said Robinson, tapping Carl with the hand he had hooked through Brunelda's arm.
"Thrown out?" said Delmarche. "You don't throw out a runaway thief. You hand him over to the police. And that might happen to him in the very first thing tomorrow morning if he doesn't keep quiet."
From that moment, Carl had no further pleasure in the spectacle below, simply because he could not help it. Being crushed against Brunelda and unable to straighten himself, he leaned forward a little over the railing. Full of his own trouble, he gazed absently at the people below, who marched up to the table before the restaurant in squads of about 20 men, seized the glasses, turned round and waved them in the direction of the recuperating candidate, shouted a party slogan, emptied the glasses and set them down on the table again with what must have been a great clatter that was, however, inaudible at this height, in order to make room for the next noisy and impatient squad. On the instructions of the party leaders, the brass band which had been playing in the restaurant came out into the street. Their great wind instruments glittered against the dark crowd, but the music was almost lost in the general din. The street was now, at least on the side where the restaurant stood, packed far and wide with human beings. From up on the hill, the direction from which Carl's taxi had arrived that morning, they came streaming down. From as far as the low-lying bridge, they came rushing up, and even the people in the adjoining houses could not resist the temptation to take a personal part in this affair. On the balconies and at the windows, there was hardly anyone left but women and children, while the men came pouring out of the house doors down below. By now, the music and free drinks had achieved their aim. The assembly was great enough at last. One of the leaders, flanked on either side by headlamps, signaled the band to stop playing and gave a loud whistle, and at once the man carrying the candidate hastily turned back and could be seen approaching through a path opened for him by supporters. The candidate had barely reached the restaurant door when he began a new speech in the blaze of the headlamps, which were now concentrated upon him in a narrow ring. But conditions were much less comfortable than before. His gigantic bearer had now no initiative at all in movement, for the crowd was too dense. His chief supporters, who had previously done their best in all kinds of way to enhance the effect of his words, now had the greatest difficulty in keeping near him, and only about 20 of them managed to retain their footing beside the bearer. Even he, strong giant as he was, could not take a step of his own free will, and it was out of the question to think of influencing the crowd by turning to face this section or that, by making dramatic advances or retreats. The mob was flowing backwards and forwards without plan, each man propelled by his neighbor. Not one braced on his own feet. The opposition party seemed to have gained a lot of new recruits. The bearer, after stemming the tide for a while outside the restaurant door, was now letting himself be swept up and down the street, apparently without resistance. The candidate still kept on uttering words, but it was no longer clear whether he was outlining his program or shouting for help, and unless Carl was mistaken, a rival candidate had made his appearance, or rather several rivals, for here and there, when light suddenly flared up, some figure could be seen high on the shoulders of the crowd, orating with a white face and clenched fists to an accompaniment of massed cheering.
"What on earth is happening down there?" asked Carl, turning in breathless bewilderment to his warders.
"How it excites the boy," said Brunelda to Delmarsh, taking hold of Carl's chin as to turn his face toward her. But that was something Carl did not desire, and made quite reckless by the events down in the street, he gave himself such a jerk that Brunelda not only let him go, but recoiled and left him quite to himself.
"You have seen enough now," she said, obviously angered by Carl's behavior. "Go into the room and make the bed and get everything ready for the night."
She pointed towards the room. That was the very direction Carl had wanted to take for hours past, and he made no objection at all. Then from the street came a loud crash of breaking glass. Carl could not restrain himself and took a flying leap to the railing for a hasty look down. The opposition had brought off a grand coup, perhaps a decisive one. The car headlamps of the candidate's party, which had thrown a powerful light on at least the central figures and afforded a measure of publicity which controlled the proceedings up to this point, had all been simultaneously smashed, and the candidate and his bearer were now received into the embrace of the general uncertain street lighting, which in its sudden diffusion had the effect of complete darkness. No one could have guessed even approximately the candidate's whereabouts, and the illusoriness of the darkness was still more enhanced by a loud swelling chorus in unison, which suddenly broke out from the direction of the bridge and was coming nearer.
"Haven't I told you what to do?" said Brunelda. "Hurry up! I'm tired," she added, stretching her arms above her so that her bosom arched out even more than before.
Delmarsh, whose arm was still round her, drew her into a corner of the balcony. Robinson followed them to push out of the way the remains of his supper, which were still lying there. Such a favorable opportunity was not to be let slip. This was no time for Carl to look down at the street. He would see enough of what was happening there once he was down below, much better than from up here. In two bounds, he was through the room with its dim red lighting, but the door was locked and the key taken away. It must be found at once. Yet who could expect to find a key in this disorder, and above all in the little space of precious time which Carl had at his disposal? Actually, he should be on the stairs by now, running and running, instead of which he was hunting for a key. He looked in all the drawers that would open, rummaged about on the table, where various dishes, table napkins, and pieces of half-begun embroidery were lying about, was allured next by an easy chair on which lay an inextricable heap of old clothes where the key might possibly be hidden but could never be found, and flung himself finally on the couch, which was indeed evil-smelling, so as to feel in all its nooks and corners for the key. Then he stopped looking and came to a halt in the middle of the room. Brunelda was certain to have the key fastened to her belt, he told himself. So many things hung there. All searching was in vain. And blindly, Carl seized two knives and thrust them between the wings of the door, one above and one below, as to get the greatest purchase on it from two separate points. But scarcely did he brace himself against the knives when the blades, of course, broke off. He wished for nothing better. The stumps, with which he could now get closer, would hold them more firmly. And now he wrenched at them with all his strength, his arms outstretched, his legs wide apart, panting and carefully watching the door at the same time. It could not resist for much longer. He realized that with joy from the audible loosening of the lock, but the more slowly he went, the better. The lock mustn't burst open, or else they would hear it on the balcony. It must loosen itself quite gradually, and he worked with great caution to bring this about, putting his face closer and closer to the lock.
"Just look at this," he heard the voice of Delmarsh.
All three of them were standing in the room. The curtain was already drawn behind them. Carl could not have heard them entering, and at the sight of them he let go of the knives. But he was given no time to utter a word of explanation or excuse, for in a fit of rage far greater than the occasion merited, Delmarsh leapt at him, the loose cord of his dressing gown describing a long figure in the air. At the very last moment Carl evaded his attack. He could have pulled the knives from the door and defended himself with them,
but it did not do so. Instead, ducking down and then springing up, he seized the broad collar of Delmarche's dressing gown, jerked it upwards, and then pulled it still farther over. The dressing gown was far too big for Delmarche, and now by good luck had a hold of the head of Delmarche, who, taken completely by surprise, pawed wildly with his hands at first, and only after a moment or two began to beat Carl on the back with his fists, but with less than his full strength, while Carl, to protect his face, flung himself against Delmarche's chest. Carl endured the blows, though they made him twist with pain and kept increasing in violence, for it was easy to bear them when he thought he saw victory before him. With his hands round Delmarche's head and the thumbs just over the eyes, he pushed him towards the part of the room where the furniture stood thickest, and at the same time, with the toe of his shoe, tried to twist the cord of the dressing gown around Delmarche's legs to trip him up. But since he had to bend all his attention on Delmarche, whose resistance he could feel growing more and more, and whose sinewy body was bracing itself with greater enmity against him, he actually forgot that he was not alone in the room with Delmarche. Only too soon the remainder came, for suddenly his feet flew from under him, being wrenched apart by Robinson, who was lying shrieking behind him on the floor. Panting, Carl let go of his hold of Delmarche, who recoiled a little. Brunelda, her legs straddling, her knees bent, a bulky figure in the middle of the room, was following the fight with glittering eyes. As if she herself were taking part in it, she was breathing deeply, screwing up her eyes and slowly advancing her fists. Delmarche flung back the collar of his dressing gown and now had the use of his eyes. Of course, it was no longer a fight, but simply a punishment. He seized Carl by the shirt front, lifted him nearly off the floor, and without even looking at him in his contempt, flung him so violently against the chest standing a few steps away that at first Carl thought the searing pains in his back and his head caused by the collision were the direct result of Delmarche's handling. "You scoundrel!" he could hear Delmarche shouting in the darkness that rose before his wavering eyes, and as he sank down, fainting beside the chest, the words, "You just wait," still rang dimly in his ears. When he came to his senses, everything was dark around him. It seemed to be late in the night. From the balcony, a faint glimmer of moonlight came into the room beneath the curtain. He could hear the regular breathing of the three sleepers. By far the loudest noise came from Brunelda, who snorted in her sleep as she sometimes did in talking. Yet it was not easy to make out where the different sleepers were lying, for the whole room was filled with the sound of their breathing. Not until he had examined his surroundings for a little while did Carl think of himself, and then he was struck with alarm, for though he was quite cramped and stiff with pain, he had not imagined that he could have been severely wounded to the effusion of blood. Yet now he felt a weight on his head, and his whole face, his neck, and his breast under the shirt were wet as if with blood. He must get into the light to find out exactly what condition he was in. Perhaps they had crippled him, in which case Delmarche would be glad enough to let him go. But what could he hope to do if that were so? There would be no prospects for him at all. The lad with the nose half eaten away occurred to him, and for a moment he buried his face in his hands. Then involuntarily he turned towards the outside door and groped his way towards it on all fours. Presently he felt a shoe and then a leg under his fingertips. That must be Robinson. Who else would sleep in his shoes? They must have ordered him to lie across the door so as to keep Carl from escaping. But didn't they know, then, the condition that Carl was in? For the moment he was not thinking of escape. He merely wanted to reach the light. So, as he couldn't get out by the door, he must make for the balcony. He found the dining table in quite a different place from the evening before. The couch, which he had approached very cautiously, was to his surprise vacant. But in the middle of the room he came upon a high, though closely compressed, pile of clothes, blankets, curtains, cushions, and carpets. At first he thought it was only a small pile, like the one he had found at the end of the couch the previous evening, and that it had merely happened to fall on the floor, but to his astonishment he discovered, on creeping further, that a whole vanload of such things was lying there, which, presumably for use in the night, must have been taken out of the trunks where they were kept during the day. He crept right around the pile and soon realized that the whole formed a sort of bed, on top of which, he discovered by feeling cautiously, Delmarche and Brunelda were sleeping. So now he knew where they all were, and made haste to reach the balcony. It was quite a different world on the other side of the curtain, and he quickly rose to his feet. In the fresh night air he walked up and down the balcony a few times in the full radiance of the moon. He looked down at the street, it was quite still. Music was still issuing from the restaurant, but more subdued now. A man was sweeping the pavement before the door.
in the street where only a few hours ago the tumult had been so great that the shouting of an electoral candidate could not be distinguished among a thousand other voices, the scratching of the broom on the flagstones could be distinctly heard. The scraping of table legs on the next balcony made Carl aware that someone was sitting there reading. It was a young man with a little pointed beard, which he kept continually twisting as he read, his lips moving rapidly at the same time. He was facing Carl, sitting at a little table covered with books. He had taken the electric lamp from the parapet and shored it between two big volumes, so that he sat in a flood of garish light. "Good evening," said Carl, for he thought he noticed the young man glancing at him. But that must have been an error, for the young man, apparently quite unaware of him, put his hands to his eyes to shield them from the light and make out who had suddenly spoken to him, and then, still unable to see anything, held up the electric lamp so as to throw some light on the next balcony.
"Good evening," said the man in return, with a brief, penetrating look, adding, "And what do you want?"
"Am I disturbing you?" asked Carl.
"Of course, of course," said the man, returning the lamp again to its former place.
These words certainly discouraged any attempt at intercourse, but at the same time, Carl did not quit the corner of the balcony nearest to the man. Silently, he watched him reading his book, turning the pages, now and then looking up to something in another book, which he always snatched up at lightning speed, and frequently making notes in a jotter, which he did with his face surprisingly close to the paper. Could this man be a student? It certainly looked as if he were. Not very unlike this, a long time ago now, Carl had sat at home at his parents' table writing out his school tasks, while his father read the newspaper or did bookkeeping and correspondence for a society to which he belonged, and his mother was busy sewing, drawing the thread high out of the stuff in her hand. To avoid disturbing his father, Carl used to lay only the exercise book and his writing materials on the table, while he arranged his reference books on chairs to the right and left of him. How quiet it had been there! How seldom strangers had visited their home! Even as a small child, Carl had always been glad to see his mother turning the key in the outside door of an evening. She had no idea that he had come to such a pass as to try breaking open strange doors with knives. And what had been the point of all his studying? He had forgotten everything. If he had been given the chance of continuing his studies here, he would have found it a very hard task. Once he remembered, he had been ill for a whole month at home. What an effort it had cost him afterwards to get used to his interrupted studies again. And now, except for the Handbook of English Commercial Correspondence, he had not read a book for ever so long.
"I say, young man," Carl found himself suddenly addressed, "couldn't you stand somewhere else? You disturb me frightfully, staring like that. After 2 o'clock in the morning, one can surely expect to be allowed to work in peace on a balcony. Do you want anything from me?"
"Are you studying?" asked Carl.
"Yes, yes," said the man, taking advantage of this wasted moment to bring new order among his books.
"Then I won't disturb you," said Carl. "I'm going indoors again in any case. Good night." The man did not even answer. With abrupt resolution, he had returned to his book again after dealing with the disturbance, his head leaning heavily on his right hand. But just before he reached the curtain, Carl remembered why he had actually come out. He did not even know how much he had been hurt. What could it be that was lying so heavy on his head? He put his hand up and stared in astonishment. There was no blood-stained wound such as he had feared in the darkness of the room, but only a turban-like bandage which was still rather wet. To judge from little frills of lace hanging from it here and there, it had been torn from an old chemise of Brunelda's, and Robinson must have wrapped it hurriedly around his head. But he had forgotten to wring it out, and so, while Carl was unconscious, the water had dripped down his face and under his shirt, and that was what had given him such a shock.
"Are you still there?" asked the man, peering across.
"I'm really going now," said Carl. "I only wanted to look at something. It's quite dark indoors."
"But who are you?"
said the man, laying his pen on the open book before him and advancing to the railing. "What's your name? How do you come to be with these people? Have you been long here? What did you want to look at? Turn on the electric light there, won't you, so that I can see you?" Carl obeyed, but before answering, he drew the curtain more closely to keep those inside from noticing anything.
"Excuse me," he said in a whisper, "for not raising my voice more. If they were to hear me there would be another row."
"Another?" asked the man.
"Yes," said Carl. "I had a terrible row with them this evening. I must still have a pretty bad bump on my head." And he felt the back of his head.
"What was the trouble?" asked the man, and as Carl did not at once reply, he added,
You can safely tell me anything you have against these people, for I hate all three of them, and the madam in particular. Besides, I'd be surprised to find that they hadn't put you up against me already. My name is Joseph Mendel, and I'm a student.
Well, said Carl, they've told me about you already, but nothing bad. You doctored Brunelda once, didn't you?
That's right, said the student, laughing. Does the couch still stink of it?
Oh, yes, said Carl.
I'm glad of that anyway, said the student, passing his fingers through his hair. And why did they give you bumps on the head?
We had a quarrel, said Carl,
wondering how he was to explain it to the student. Then he checked himself and asked,
But am I not disturbing you?
In the first place, said the student, you have already disturbed me, and I am unluckily so nervous that I need a long time to get into my stride again. Ever since you began to walk about on your balcony, I haven't been able to get on with my studies. And then, in the second place, I always have a breather about 3 o'clock, so you needn't have any scruples about telling me. Besides, I'm interested.
It's quite simple, said Carl. Delmarsh wants me to be his servant, but I don't want to. I should have liked to leave this very night. He wouldn't let me go, and he locks the door. I tried to break it open, and then there was a row. I'm unlucky to still be here.
Why, have you got another job? Asked the student.
No, said Carl.
But that doesn't worry me in the least if I could only get away from here.
What? Said the student. It doesn't worry you in the least, doesn't it?
And both of them were silent for a moment.
Why don't you want to stay with these people? The student asked at last.
Delmarsh is a bad man, said Carl. I've encountered him before. I tramped for a whole day with him once, and I was glad to be out of his company. And am I to be his servant now?
If all servants were as fastidious in their choice of masters as you are, said the student, and he seemed to be smiling. Look here, during the day I'm a salesman, a miserable counter-jumper, not much more than an errand boy in Motley's big store. This Motley is certainly a scoundrel, but that leaves me quite cold. What makes me furious is simply that the pay is wretched. Let that be an example to you.
What?
Said Carl.
You are a salesman all day and you study all night?
Yes, said the student. There's nothing else to be done. I've tried everything possible, but this is the best way. For years I did nothing but study day and night, and I almost didn't dare attend lectures in the clothes I had to wear, but that's all behind me now.
But when do you sleep? Asked Carl, looking at the student in wonder.
Oh, sleep? Said the student. I'll get some sleep when I'm finished with my studies. I keep myself going on black coffee. And he turned round, drew a big bottle from under the table, poured black coffee from it into a little cup, and tossed it down his throat as if it were medicine which he wanted to get quickly over, to avoid the taste. A fine thing, black coffee, said the student. It's a pity you're too far away for me to reach you some.
I don't like black coffee, said Carl.
I don't either, said the student, laughing. But what could I do without it? If it weren't for black coffee, Motley wouldn't keep me for a minute. I say Motley, although of course he's not even aware of my existence. I simply don't know how I would get on in the shop if I didn't have a big bottle like this under the counter, for I've never dared to risk stopping the coffee drinking. But can you believe me that if I did, I would roll down behind the counter in a dead sleep? Unfortunately, the others have tumbled to that. They call me Black Coffee, a silly witticism which I'm sure has damaged my career already.
And then will you be finished with your studies? Asked Carl.
I'm getting on slowly, said the student, with a drooping head. He left the railing and sat down again at the table, planting his elbows on the open book and passing his fingers through his hair, and he said then, It might take me another year or two.
I wanted to study too, said Carl,
as if that gave him a claim to be on a more confidential footing than the student, now fallen silent, had seen fit to grant.
Indeed, said the student,
and it was not quite clear whether he was reading his book again or merely staring absently at it. You can be glad that you've given up studying. I've studied for years now simply for the sake of mere consistency. I get very little satisfaction out of it, and even less hope for the future. What prospects could I have? America is full of quack doctors.
I wanted to be an engineer, put in Carl quickly as the student seemed to be losing all interest.
And now you're supposed to be a servant to these people, said the student, glancing up for a moment. That annoys you, of course. This conclusion sprang from the misunderstanding, but Carl felt that he might turn it to his advantage, so he asked,
Perhaps I could get a job in the store, too.
The question detached the student completely from his book, but the idea that he might be of some help to Carl in applying for such a post did not enter his mind at all.
You try it, he said,
Or rather, don't you try it. Getting a job at Motley's is the biggest success I've ever scored. If I had to give up either of my studies or my job, of course I'd give up my studies. I spent all my energy trying to keep off the horns of that dilemma. So it's as hard as that to get a job at Motley's? Said Carl, more to himself than to the student. Why? What do you think? Said the student. It's easier to be appointed district judge here than a door opener at Motley's. Carl fell silent. This student, who was so much more experienced than he was, and who hated Delmarsh for some unknown reason, and who certainly felt no ill will towards himself, could not give him a single word of encouragement to leave Delmarsh. And yet, he didn't know anything about the danger threatening Carl from the police, which Delmarsh could shield him from at any moment. You saw the demonstration down there this evening, didn't you? Anyone who didn't know the ropes could easily imagine, couldn't he, that that candidate, Lobster is his name, would have some prospect of getting in, or at least being considered.
I know nothing about politics, said Carl.
That's a mistake, said the student. But you have eyes and ears in your head, haven't you? The man obviously has friends and opponents. That surely can't have escaped you. Well, in my opinion, the fellow hasn't the slightest prospect of being returned. I happen to know all about him. There's a man staying here who's an acquaintance of his. He's not without ability, and as far as his political views and his political past are concerned, he actually would be the most suitable judge for the district. But no one even imagines that he can get in. He'll come as a big cropper as anyone can. He'll have chucked away his dollars on the election campaign, and that will be all. Carl and the student gazed at each other for a little while in silence. The student nodded smilingly and pressed his hand against his weary eyes. Well, aren't you going to bed yet? He asked. I must start on my reading again. Look how much I still have to do. And he fluttered over half the pages of the book to give Carl an idea of the work that still awaited him. Well then, good night, said Carl with a bow. Come over and see us sometime, said the student, who had sat down at the table again. Of course, only if you'd like to. You'll always find lots of company here, and I can always have time for you from 9 till 10 in the evening.
So you advise me to stay with Delmarsh? Asked Carl.
Absolutely, said the student, whose head was already bent over in his book. It was as if not he but someone else had said the word. It echoed in Carl's ears as if it had been uttered by a voice more hollow than the student's. Slowly he went up to the curtain, glanced once more at the student, who now sat quite motionless in his ring of light, surrounded by the vast darkness, and slipped into the room. The united breathing of the three sleepers received him. He felt his way along the wall to the couch, and when he found it, calmly stretched himself out on it as if it were his familiar bed. Since the student, who knew all about Delmarsh and the queer circumstances, and who was moreover an educated man, had advised him to stay here, he had no qualms for the time being. He did not have such high aims as the student. Perhaps even at home he would never have succeeded in carrying his studies to their conclusion. And if it were difficult to do that at home, no one could expect to manage it here in a strange land. But his prospects of finding a post in which he could achieve something, and be appreciated for his achievement, would be greater if he accepted the servant's place with Delmarsh for the time being, and from that secure position watched for a favorable opportunity. In this very street there appeared to be many offices of middling or inferior status, which in case of need might not be too fastidious in picking their staff. He would be glad to take on a porter's job if necessary, but after all, it was not utterly impossible that he might be taken on simply for office work, and in the future might sit at his own desk as a regular clerk, gazing occasionally out of an open window with a light heart, like the clerk whom he had seen that morning on his expedition through the courtyards. As he shut his eyes, he was comforted by the reflection that he was still young, and that some day or other he was bound to get away from Delmarsh. This household certainly did not look as if it were established for all eternity. Once he got such a post in an office, he would concentrate his mind on his office work. He would not disperse his energies like the student. If it should be necessary, he would devote his nights as well as his days to his office work, which, at the start, might actually be expected of him, considering his meager knowledge of business matters. He would think only of the interests of the firm he had to serve, and undertake any work that they offered, even work which other clerks rejected as beneath them. Good intentions thronged into his head, as if his future employer were standing before the couch and could read them from his face. On such thoughts, Carl fell asleep, and only in his first light slumber was disturbed by a deep sigh from Brunelda, who was apparently troubled by bad dreams and twisted and turned on her bed.